find absorbing feature articles online. abc.net.au/rn.
Across Australia on RN, online or via podcast. Hello, I'm Paul Barclay. Thanks for joining me for Big Ideas. Tonight, a radical restructure of work and care. Jennifer Nadelsky calls for deliberation on her proposal to completely rebalance the challenges of employment, life, family and care. Her idea? That everybody, and she does mean everybody, engage in both paid part-time work and unpaid part-time care. In this talk, she argues that the current arrangements are behind many of the social ills we experience today, and she explains how her new norms of care might function. Jennifer Nadelsky is a professorial fellow at the Institute for Social Justice at the Australian Catholic University and professor of law at the University of Toronto. Let's now head to the North Sydney campus of the Australian Catholic University and an event hosted by the Sydney School for Critical Social Thought. Here's Professor Jennifer Nadelsky with her lecture, Restructuring Work and Care.
So first, let me just say that this argument is really aimed at well-off Western societies. So I think that the core insights about work and care apply everywhere, but the kind of thing that I'm talking about would involve a radical reduction in both production and consumption. Now, in the Western societies, this is basically to the good, but it's not clear to me that that's true everywhere in the world, that that is what one should be after. The basic framework that I have is that I see Western societies as facing three critical problems that arise out of dysfunctional norms of work and care. And those problems are unsustainable stress on families, persistent inequality for women and others who do care work, and policymakers who are ignorant about the care work that life requires. We urgently need collective deliberation about radical transformation of these norms. And I have a proposal that I hope will spark that deliberation. So let me open with an example of a very recent change in norms that captures the kind of change that I'll be proposing here. A friend of mine asked a young male colleague at a Swedish university whether he would be taking the full paternity leave available to him when his wife had their first child, or whether he would feel career pressure not to. And he answered, "Are you kidding? If I didn't take the leave, all my colleagues would be saying, who knew he was a money-grubbing careerist?" So this is an example of transforming a long-standing, widespread concern that to take parental leave will undermine one's prospects with one's colleagues. The norms had so shifted that to fail to do so would create disapprobation. That's the kind of change I'm looking for. My project here is to radically change the kinds of things that generate approval and disapproval among one's colleagues, friends, family, neighbors, and society in general. I'm advocating new norms about how everyone should engage in employment and in care work. So my proposal, the nutshell of it is, all mature, competent adults are expected to be employed part-time, or what we would now call part-time. So no less than 12, everybody works, everybody does some paid work. No less than 12 hours, no more than 30 hours a week. And to do care work part-time, also somewhere between 12 and 30 hours a week. The failure to meet those norms would generate the sort of disapproval, embarrassment, pity, and unease that currently would arise if a competent adult male announced at a party that he had never held a job. Thus, the norms would be enforced by serious social constraint, like most norms, but not by the law. Without such a transformation, we cannot hope to solve the three pressing problems I noted at the outset. So let me just say another brief word about each of those problems. The first problem is the unsustainable structure of work and family life that puts enormous stress on families and forces workers at all levels into untenable choices between work and family. The stress has serious consequences, including health and autonomy for all, and I think almost certainly harms children with long-term intergenerational consequences. The second problem is that the shift in gender norms and the inequality of women improves at a glacial pace, leaving women still with less pay, less economic security, vulnerability to poverty, less leisure time, less access to top jobs, and even in countries like Canada, less access to high-quality health care. Moreover, equality more generally, so not just gender equality, requires an equitable distribution of care work. As long as only a subset of the population does the care work, both the work and the people who do it will be denigrated. Indeed, the current structures of work and care are a recipe not only for a wide variety of social ills, but for a population too stressed and exhausted to protest them. The third problem is the least commented on in the now extensive literature on care. I call it the policy-care divide. This means that those in top policy-making positions are almost always people with very little experience of the demands or satisfactions or importance of caretaking. In my view, this means that policymakers are, for the most part, ignorant of a core dimension of human life. This renders them unfit for the job. We should no more consider electing someone without substantial experience in caregiving to public office or appointing them to be CEO of a corporation than we would someone who had never held a job. Those who do have the requisite knowledge and experience, primarily women, have very limited access to high-level policymaking positions. The underlying claim here is that experiential knowledge of care is essential to good policy. And I think this policy care divide is very important because many otherwise successful arguments that try to make a gender division of care compatible with gender equality run afoul of this policy care divide. My claim is that none of the problems I mentioned can be fixed unless everyone, with no exceptions, participates in part-time unpaid care and part-time paid work. So now let me just say a word about norm change. Norms are an important challenge for democratic deliberation. Some of the most powerful norms, like gender norms, that women should do the care work for their family, and the expectation that adult males should be employed full-time, are so deeply entrenched that they seem like facts of life rather than collective choices about how we should live. But they are collective choices, and they're subject to change. Everyone knows that norms around women's employment have changed, and they might remember from novels or movies that there was a time when to be a gentleman meant to be unemployed. It was a mark of superiority, not failure. And people might also remember the more recent phrase of banker's hours, suggesting that men in that line of work could play golf in the afternoon. That, of course, is a far cry from the hours that now characterize employment in the financial sector. So norms shape people's lives. They are coercive and exclusionary by nature, all norms. It's therefore essential that societies develop modes of democratic deliberation about norms, not just laws and what is recognized as public policy. In the case of norms of work and care, I mean by democratic deliberation about norm change, conversations everywhere, playgrounds, cafes, classrooms, water coolers, boardrooms. It's urgent that people everywhere ask themselves and each other what norms of work and care should really be. How do they actually want to live? So in some ways, this is a manifesto, but the point is deliberation. What I really think is that we need a change in the conversation, which is actually already happening. So I'm sure you all know everywhere there's all this stuff out there about work-family balance, but it's all completely trivial, in my view. It's about little tiny changes, more flex time and so on. And the part of the problem is that those little changes are so urgently needed, given how terrible the work structure is, that they draw a lot of attention, but they don't draw attention to the fact that they can never really change what's fundamentally wrong. So the point of the manifesto is to prompt deliberation. It's not to insist that every piece of the argument is right, but I do think that offering what I hope will look at like a well-developed and plausible alternative is part of what will stimulate that shift in the conversation I'm after. The other thing I wanted to mention briefly is that this project began with a focus on rights. So the first thing I published from this was an argument that was structured like this: women can never really enjoy equal rights unless there is a change in the gender division of household labor. And you can't get a change in the division of household labor unless you transform the work structure. So it begins with rights, and then it talks about these other things as the means to those ends. And I will continue to make that argument because rights are such a powerful currency in the discourse, but I now think that equally important to that project is the transformation of the status and understanding of care itself. Okay, so now what I actually want to do today is to share with you how I've been working out some of the puzzles and problems around the care part of the book. And so while I think that the change in work and the change in care are necessary for each other, here I'm just going to focus on the care side. But I did want to say just one thing about background conditions. So there's lots of things that would make this whole project work better, like a guaranteed annual income. But my point is that we don't want to wait until those things are in place to get this going. But there is one thing that we would actually need, and that is an actual living wage. And so by living wage, I mean one person can support herself and a child on 20 hours a week. Now, if you think about this, this is not very different from the post-war living wage where a man could support himself and his family on 40 hours a week. So there was a period when capitalism thrived with a living wage. So this is a different calling for a different kind of living wage. If we don't have that, I don't think the system can work. Okay, so now I'm going to turn first to some basic definitions of what I mean by care. Now, it's important for me to divide up what counts as care and what counts as work so that people can ensure that they're doing a reasonable amount of both. Remember, you have obligations on both sides, so you need to know which is which. Now, of course, care involves work, and work has or should have components of care. This means that there's a certain arbitrariness to these two categories. But in my view, it's not possible at this point in history to create new norms of work and care without a provisional definition of each. I think the difficulties and even arbitrariness in deciding what counts as care and what is work will prove to be fruitful. Thinking through these puzzles will reveal the diverse forms of care and how central they are to good work and to all dimensions of life. Thinking through the value of work will also highlight the overlap between the meaning of contribution in the spheres that I'm defining as work and care. So I'm often going to use this language of paid work and unpaid care. Okay, so now to some of the puzzles of what counts as care. So the core of what I mean by care is the effort and attention necessary directly to sustain and develop life and to relieve pain and suffering. This definition includes the need for mental, spiritual, and emotional, as well as physical well-being. And of course, in many economies, certainly the ones I have in mind, one might say that working to provide income, or attaching oneself to an income earner, is the core of what makes sustaining life possible. But that's the dimension I'm designating as work. So by care, mostly, I have a paragraph, but I mean most of the things that will be fairly self-evident, you know, shopping, cooking, cleaning, planning meals, taking care of children, ensuring their education, medical care, all the transportation organization, all that stuff. It also includes the emotional care that may attend some of this more physical labor, as well as time for talking, listening, laughing, cuddling, soothing, supporting, that sustains human bonding. Now, a particularly important form of emotional care under this new system is the time, attention, and openness that people devote to working out conflicts in close relationships. Friends, lovers, spouses, parents, and children. This is particularly important because I think the creation of care communities, which I'm about to get to, will increase the number of people with whom one has relationships that require this kind of care and attention to conflict. Learning the skills to do this well is part of the care skills everyone will need to learn. So I just want to note, again, we can talk about this more later, but some paid care will remain under the system I envision, but the need for it will be radically reduced because of the amount of care work everybody's doing. And similarly, care remains important for families. That's really my starting point. But the key here is that care obligations are not limited to families. Instead, they extend to self-chosen communities of care, which I will turn to shortly. So part of what this means is that my project deliberately breaks conventional links between care and family, between care and state — most of what I'm talking about is not state provision of care — and between care and market, because I'm talking about unpaid care.
Jennifer Nadelsky, Professor of Law at the University of Toronto. On RN or online, you're with Big Ideas. Back now to the North Sydney campus of the Australian Catholic University for more on Jennifer Nadelsky's radical restructuring of work and care.
My project, which I take to be a difficult one, is to create norms such that everyone does care work. One of my overarching concerns in defining care in this context is to avoid the powerful urge and current norm to avoid doing care on the grounds that what you're doing is really important and the kind of thing that not just anyone could do, unlike lowly care. So even though your paid work involves care, like being a doctor or a teacher, you are not relieved of your unpaid care obligations. So think about this first in terms of care of the self, of your own self. So under current norms, a specialized surgeon might well think that he should not waste his time cooking and cleaning. Even those who can avoid a certain sense of self-importance might believe that it would be a waste of their valuable and perhaps publicly funded training to be a doctor to spend time on such menial chores. I have to say that Philippe von Paris, you know, author of The Great Guarantee, he made that argument to me. You wouldn't want your doctors wasting time on this. But for me, such a stance raises the question, is there really anyone that we think is too important, too specially talented or trained to pick up his own socks and wash them, or to feed himself and wash the dishes? Of course, this question cannot really be answered without considering the demands of work. The transformation of neither work nor care can be accomplished without both. I think part of the resistance to acknowledging an obligation, even to care for oneself, instead of relying on others, paid or unpaid, to do it for one, is that for many people, the demands of work are so overwhelming, and in the best of cases, so compelling, that if it is possible to get others to take up the chores of care, that seems urgently desirable. I think that for many, the suggestion that we should remove that option would seem to threaten a barely sustainable system of coping. I put many professional women with young children in this category. I think people cannot take seriously the idea of doing a lot more care unless they also envision a radical reduction in the demands of paid work. Such a reduction would reduce the current stress that colors people's relation to care. Indeed, I think a great deal of what are currently strongly held personal preferences about how to spend your time are shaped by patterns of stress caused by excessive demands from paid work, often compounded by conflicting demands of work and care. I'll return to the issue of individual preference and temperament, but here I want to suggest that there are many forms of care work, such as chopping vegetables, bringing order to a messy room, even cleaning, that people experience as unpleasant, even oppressive, because these chores prevent them from doing the things they think are important and pressing, especially, but not exclusively, paid work. But I think if one does not feel rushed and pressed for time, each such task can be satisfying, especially if one does other things as well. The mix of work and care that I advocate, I think, will transform how people experience both. Okay, so here's another thing that is not care. Activism is not care, and neither is scholarship on care or social justice. Another way of thinking about the question is, again, who shouldn't have to pick up their own socks? Is to think about the care responsibilities of people who make it their life work to fight for important causes, like reducing poverty or protecting the environment or trying to create right relations with Aboriginal peoples. Some who might remain unmoved by the claims of the individual or social importance of the surgeon would not want to see effective activists distracted from their work by the demands of care. Indeed, there might be people who advocate for publicly supported daycare or better care for the elderly who would claim that they make their contribution to care through this activism. And it's not just in employment, but in the activist context, that time presses. And even if not from the external demands of the organization, they're pressing issues that need urgent attention. People who work in international relief, for those in war zones or facing natural disasters. For these people, just as for high-powered lawyers or financiers, there are never enough hours in the day to do what needs doing, should some of those precious hours be taken for direct care. So as we'll see in the section on work, my system would allow for intense periods of work. So the emergency worker might need to go off for 3 or 4 months at a time and do nothing but their aid work. But then they'll be expected to come back, have time off work, and make up for their care obligations. So we have flexibility, but what we don't have is that kind of contribution relieves you from your obligation of care. So why not? The most general answer is the reasons that I just noted. Why everyone should participate in care actually do apply to everyone, including activists who promote better care. Because the activism normally is not what I'm calling direct care. Now, sometimes I think these can be integrated. But to the extent that what you're doing is advocating policy change, you're not getting the experiential, hands-on knowledge of care work that I want to say is essential. Now, one might still ask whether the cost-benefit trade-off of what people will learn from doing this experiential hands-on work is sufficient to take time away from their work as surgeons or workers or activists, especially if their care indirectly brings them a lot of second-hand knowledge about care. So this then brings us to the other reasons why everyone should provide care. The role of care in creating human connection, and thus satisfying life, both individual and collective, and the importance of the fair distribution of care work. Even people who are doing vital work in promoting care in the world should not be encouraged to disregard the immediate care needs around them that will shape the core relationships in their lives. I actually think that if we carved out exceptions for people who didn't participate in this voluntary care, on my system, they would stop being full active members of society. Similarly, if we are ever to have a just distribution of care work, we must resist all forms of the argument that important people or people doing important work don't need to do direct care work. And I have a similar argument that I'm not going to go through about why paid care is not a substitute for unpaid care. Okay, so then I have a section which I'm not going to go into now, though I'd be happy to talk about it because I think it raises some complex tensions. So care for the earth and her creatures counts as care. And what exactly does that mean? Does tending your own garden count? I'm not so sure, but we can come back to that. Another thing that I have a section on that I'm just going to mention here is a sort of reclaiming of the idea of homemaking. So this has very bad associations with kind of the 1950s housewives, but actually I think that paying attention to creating a beautiful, peaceful, harmonious home is one of the things that would be enabled by this rehabilitation of the importance of care work. Okay, so now I'm going to switch to the question of for whom do we care and how much time should we spend doing it? So this goes back to the question of family, but not just family. So I do begin with the family because I think they're particularly compelling care responsibilities within families. And very often, though not always, family members are particularly well-suited to provide the care that is needed. And I want to say also that it's very important for me in this project to notice how much family forms are changing. So I think in the U.S. it's now the case that the majority of children do not live in homes with two parents. So there's a radical transformation going on, and which is not just about, you know, same-sex couples. Huge shifts with very important implications for economic status. But I think this approach of mine will actually facilitate the multiplication of good alternative family forms. So I really don't see it as tied in any way to the sort of two-parent heterosexual family, or for that matter, two-parent same-sex family. But so that the relationship to family is important, but it is going to exceed family. So one of the important things one learns when one does care, and often fails to understand when one doesn't, is that it matters who does the care for whom. Caregivers are very often not interchangeable. I think people learn this most readily in the family. A sick or sad child often wants a parent, even a particular parent, for comfort. And people often urgently want to be there for a child, a spouse, a sibling, an elderly parent who is suffering and needs care. Care builds bonds. When people are cared for by a loved one, they are often able to feel, recognize, appreciate, and believe in the love they receive. And their own love develops and is also recognized and appreciated by the caregiver as it takes form in care. Bonds call for care. If that call cannot be met, it causes suffering for both the one who needs it and the one who wants to provide it. In sum, the family is a location where people learn the link between connection and care and the importance of who does the care. I have various stories of people who had colleagues who couldn't understand that hiring a caregiver was not going to be an adequate substitute for taking care of a child with a broken leg and in pain. So the family is also the source of demands for care, and in the current arrangements, it's a source of great stress in trying to meet the demands of care at the same time that one meets the demands of work. The part-time care hours I propose need to be enough, so now we're starting to get to the time dimension I'll come to in a minute. They need to be enough for family members to meet the individual and collective care needs of their household, including the various things I listed at the outset. Now, for people with young children, the time demands of this list of the care needs of the household may well cover most of their care responsibilities. They'll meet their obligations to do unpaid care by taking care of their family needs in the household. But many will also have care responsibilities for aging relatives and perhaps for friends with mental or physical health problems. Where there is a need for care in my model, there will be someone with a responsibility for meeting it. For people whose responsibilities for families and friends are not demanding, the expectation would be that they would form wider communities of care in which they would meet their care responsibilities. So if your needs with your immediate family do not add up to your hours of obligatory care, you're going to create communities of care. So now let me say a little bit about the communities of care.
Jennifer Nadelsky, Professorial Fellow at the Institute for Social Justice, Australian Catholic University, our hosts for this talk on restructuring work and care. On RN or online, you're with Big Ideas. Let's continue with the talk. Here's Jennifer Nadelsky.
The new norms would generate expectations of caring attention to the needs of one's neighbors, one's community, however defined. This is, of course, a demanding norm. In particular, it means that one's care obligations would not be defined by the arc of an individual life. So intense obligations when your kids are young, maybe again when your parents are elderly. but with the expectation that these care obligations decrease over time. Another way of highlighting the demanding nature of what I propose is this. One can never retire from care, though one can take care vacations. And here I might note that I'm now at this stage of semi-retirement from care and enjoying it a lot. My children are in their mid-20s and doing well, though with some health problems. They don't live with us. They claim my attention and concern, financial support as students, but not usually day-to-day direct care. This, in turn, permits me to experiment with taking up wider care engagement. But so far, I have to confess that I treat this community engagement as optional, to be pushed aside when there's an academic deadline, in the way that demands for children cannot be. The norms I am advocating would not treat these wider commitments as a matter of discretion or preference in the ways I am currently doing. So how people would choose and create communities of care is one of the interesting parts of what I envision. It's not one I've worked out fully, but I want to just share with you a bit about how I picture this. So I picture a wide variety of communities. For some, their geographical neighborhood, the people who live close to them, would form the community within which they create norms of mutual care. These norms would be reciprocal in the widest sense that everyone in the community is expected to participate and benefit, but not in the quid pro quo sense that I will repay the care you give me with that same kind of care for you. It would involve patterns of attention to who has what needs and mostly individual responses by those who have the ability and inclination to meet them. I do envision periodic conversations about what the needs are, what counts as care, what are the different ways of providing care, but I do not envision much central coordination, in part because I picture fairly small communities of care. I imagine that others will choose faith communities as their communities of care. These are communities that have often already worked out practices of mutual care that could be expanded so that everyone in the community takes up these additional care responsibilities. Others still might find that the community with which they have and want to sustain the closest bonds are communities of shared interest in arts, politics, sports, like one's choir or soccer club or environmental action group. Such communities would need to work out ways of letting each other know about their care needs and abilities to meet care needs. Both things can be quite challenging, as there are strong norms around competence and independence, which make it difficult for many people to reveal their needs. And this is even true in church communities who do have longstanding practices of mutual care. The basic point here is that in periods of people's lives when the needs of their immediate family and friends do not take up, say, 20 hours of their time each week, they would not reduce their care, but transfer it to their chosen community of care. So let me just turn, and within the context of my project, to the particular issue of individual preference, temperament, and talent. So while I begin the conversation about preference with an acknowledgement of increased constraint and coercion in the context of care, it's equally important to situate it in the context of the current constraint and coercion around work. So when I have presented this argument, I fairly frequently get questions like, well, but you know, some people just, they don't like caregiving. And so if you force them to do it, they won't be good at it. They can contribute in other ways. So why should they be forced? Now, of course, in our contemporary capitalism, and indeed throughout most of history, one does not hear a parallel comment on work. Oh, I'm just not one of those people well-suited to working full-time, you know, and if anybody made me, I would do a bad job of it. And so it, you know, really be a violation of my freedom and my temperament. So it's very important to kind of hold that next to this sense of what an unpardonable intrusion it would be to have compulsory norms of care. So my argument is that in a well-functioning society, we do need norms of the work required from all capable adults and similarly norms of participating in the care that life requires by all those who are capable. Reasons of equality and avoiding the care policy divide yield norms that everyone participates in both paid work and unpaid care. So then the question of individual preference or talent or temperament becomes a question of flexibility and the range of ways in which people can meet their care obligations. I think the objections and concern divide along the kind of care people have in mind when they say they just don't want to do it. There might be a basic objection, I don't like cooking, cleaning, or any of the mundane forms of what some people call non-nurturant or non-intimate care, these kind of routine tasks. And then they might say, since I don't like it, the requirement that I participate will be unduly oppressive. I should be able to do the kind of care work I like and will be good at, like reading to the kids and playing games with them and helping them with their homework while someone else does the stuff I don't like. And maybe they like it. There can also be a sort of opposite concern, especially with respect to non-family members. So I hear this around this communities of care model. Well, I'm just not the sort of person who's good at sitting by sick beds, listening to the elderly ramble on. This sort of hand-holding is not my thing. And they'd be able to tell that I don't like it. I don't want to be there. So someone else should do it. Now, I have a different intuition about how to respond to this temperamental preference stuff within the family on the one hand and in the wider community on the other. So within the family, I think it is important that virtually all care be done by everyone capable of doing it. It's important not to enact hierarchies of care, such as those that place the nurturant or intimate care above non-nurturant care, like cleaning. The association of hierarchies of care with hierarchies of persons is very long-standing and deeply entrenched. As long as there are some spheres of care that we look down on as beneath most of us, there will be people who are similarly looked down on as those who do that care. The link between inequality and the structure of care cannot be broken unless care in the family models the idea that care is needed by all and therefore done by all. At this point in history, personal preferences around care are so intertwined around norms of hierarchy that they should be given almost no weight within the family. Similarly, the I'm just not good at it should be met with, preferably patient, time for learning to get good enough at it. It seems possible to me that after a couple of generations raised under the new norms, it might be reasonable for families to allocate some tasks according to preference. But remembering that that allocation still has to be on the model that everybody knows how to do the basics. Outside the family, I have a different intuition. In the wider community of care, there's less urgency about everyone doing something of everything, in part because the role of the family in all its forms in teaching norms is different from the work in the wider community. In the wider context, I counter the concern that some people are not good intimate caregivers with the view that there are so many forms of care that need doing that everyone will find something that suits them. If one is not drawn to the face-to-face encounters with the sick or frail, there's still shopping and cleaning to be done, snow to be shoveled, medicines to be picked up and delivered. Children need transportation, food needs to be prepared, and so on. So in the wider community, if you don't want to do the intimate care, there'll be plenty of other stuff that you can do. Now, these arguments move quickly into the quality of care concern. So interestingly, Eva Kattei, who people who know the care literature will know her great book on love's labor, this is what she was really worried about when she heard this proposal, was compulsory care will not lead to good care. And who wants to be the recipient of coerced care? Why should we think that the care would be good? Now, of course, sadly, we actually have quite a lot of experience with this. The economic coercion that forces many people into low-paid jobs in nursing homes often results in poor care, which, however, is often exacerbated by the understaffing that prevents those people from doing the care that they would actually like to do, despite the poor pay. My main response is the one above. There'll be enough different ways outside the family for people to participate in their care obligations, that everyone should be able to find something they're comfortable doing and therefore will be competent at. Now, this does raise the issue of preferences for those who are receiving care. Now, this is a big topic. I'm just going to note something briefly here. I think these importances of the preferences of the ones receiving care need to be respected, that those have to be part of the norms of care that we inculcate. A crotchety old lady's preference for particular caregivers should be respected. In addition, I've read stories of people who say that they prefer being helped by paid caregivers because this then makes them able to feel that they the time they need to have the things done the way they want to do is legitimate. As one person said, they're paying for the patience of the caregiver. So then they feel entitled to it in a way they wouldn't from a friend or family member. So the education and caregiving would need to address such issues. One can hope that in a culture in which everyone sees themselves as needing care, we all know that about ourselves, and instead of pretending that we don't, a stance of generosity and patience toward those for whom one is caring could be more easily cultivated. It's possible that in addition to lots of informal training, taking kids along, doing caretaking, schools should include education in many of the skills of care, including attention, receptivity, and listening. Finally, it's important that there's actually quite a wide range of hours. This is finally in relation to preference. I do have one other section. When people say, well, you're going to force me to do it, remember, it's a minimum of 12. That's not really a lot. 12 hours a week, everybody has to do a maximum of 30. As I envision the new system, people who spend their whole lives doing the minimum would not be especially well thought of. It seems reasonable to expect that virtually everyone will be able to find ways to contribute to care in ways that feel suitable to them. Okay, so the last part of this piece is the intrusion side.
On RN or online at abc.net.au, you're with Big Ideas. Our speaker is Professor Jennifer Nadelsky, Professor of Law at the University of Toronto, who has these concluding remarks on the restructuring of work and care.
As preface to this, the issues of intrusion, a colleague who I'm close to referred to this entire project as, oh, you mean like Maoist re-education. So I think this piece of it is part of what provokes that reaction. So intrusion into intimate relations is another potentially troubling part of the new norms. Of course, such a concern plays into old and troubling distinctions between the public and the private. As many people know by now, this distinction and the resistance to the state or anyone else telling them, especially traditionally male heads of households, how to raise their children, how to interact with their spouses, or contribute to household labor, the resistance to that has allowed both violence and injustice to characterize family life for millions of people. And of course, it's also the case that despite such heartfelt resistance, how people actually raise their children, interact with their spouses, and participate in household labor is hugely influenced by norms. These are not random individual preferences like flavors of ice cream. This issue arises as a matter of public debate because there are competing norms, and many people belong to more than one community of judgment. So the versions of this with which we're already familiar, should physical punishment be allowed in child-rearing? Should husbands be allowed to discipline their wives physically? Should men share in household labor with their female partners? These have all been hotly disputed at different times, and different societies have made different interventions in applying laws or norms. So, for example, Canada does actually permit physical punishment of children. It's an exception in the criminal code to assault. But they've mounted these big public awareness campaigns about the harm that can be done. So they've chosen to go the norm way rather than the law way on this one. But this history of the public-private division does not simply make everyone who knows it sympathetic to imposing collective norms on family life, much less norms backed by or facilitated by the state, as mine would be. Some of the resistance, for example, to the push for gay marriage in parts of the gay community arose from fears of normalizing certain kinds of gay relationships, long-term monogamous ones. And it was not just the danger to those who would then be cast as the wrong kind of gays, but a resistance to participating in dominant norms. Even among feminists who strongly support equal sharing of household labor, I observe and participate in a reluctance to inquire into the practices of my friends and colleagues. Somehow this still feels private, no matter what critique one has of the public and private distinction. So I don't actually know a lot about how equal the household division of labor is among my colleagues, though I do have guesses. Perhaps this should not be this reticence around household labels should not be surprising, given that even intimate partner violence remains an issue that many avoid recognizing or inquiring about. The family as a zone of privacy remains a view, or at least an affect, held by many who know the history and the issues I've just noted. And I have some sympathy with this. On the whole, I think it's probably a good thing that one can raise one's children as one wishes, within the boundaries of nonviolence. For example, I think there are complex reasons having to do with intimacy between parent and child that should discourage direct intervention by state or neighbors with parents who raise children according to traditional gender stereotypes. One can often, though not always, rely on media, schools, and neighborhood interactions to present children with alternatives. So this is the background against which I want to acknowledge that I think the norms I'm advocating will call for intrusion into family practices. It will be a matter of public concern whether the norm of everyone participating in the care of the household is observed. There will, of course, be no official social services one calls to report violations. These are norms, not law. But deviations from the norms will be a matter of collective concern and thus of anxiety or embarrassment or shame or anger on the part of those who do not comply. So the discussion so far reveals some of the implications of transforming the traditional links between family and care. The family is no longer the only location for one's care obligations. This means that even after one has met family obligations, one still has other care obligations. The care I've been discussing is all unpaid, voluntary, but normatively compelled care. But there will be remaining roles for the state, like providing a publicly funded child care. A great deal of the daily care people need, including the looming increase in care for the elderly, my generation, will be provided through these norms of participation by everyone. So now what about the market and the powerful link in wealthy societies between money and care? In particular, the ability of the well-off to buy care. As should be clear by now, one of the norms I want to transform is the idea that the more important you are, the less care you should have to do. Indeed, I think in our most Western cultures that I know of, the ability to buy care instead of doing it is one of the most important markers of success and importance. It's not just a privilege, it's a marker. It shows how important you are. Now, I do envision a significant amount of paid care remaining under the new system. There are many contexts in which professional care is a benefit and should be paid for. And even with reduced hours of work, some people will want to pay for care so that they can increase their leisure time, etc. What I want the new norms to oppose is a pattern of using money to pay for non-nurturant care, even if the purpose is to increase time for nurturant care. So as I discussed in the context of the division of household labor, any pattern in which the well-off avoid the dirty work by paying others to do it will reinforce a hierarchy of care and of people. Now, I feel I should say that, like thousands of other professional women, the way I have coped is by using exactly this strategy. I pay for non-nurturant care to give me time with my kids. But in the new regime that I'm proposing, this would no longer be an acceptable way of meeting one's care obligations, and preferably one hopes that with the transformation in the norms around work, people wouldn't be compelled to do it. The last comparison, which I'm not going to go into, but I'll just say, so one of the other traditional links, maybe untraditional links for feminists between care and the market is the wages for housework. So this is absolutely not that. I'm not calling for pay for this care work. I'm calling for a vast increase in unpaid care from everyone. Okay, so my last thought here is about communities of care as communities of judgment fostering relations of freedom. The constitution of communities of care, which will become part of what every capable adult needs to do, will not just be a choice of with whom one wants to create mutual obligations and bonds of care. It will also be a choice about the people with whom one wants to take up the inevitable and ongoing conversations about what constitutes care, how to accommodate preference, what are the appropriate minimum maximum hours, when is professional care desirable. I do not picture these conversations as constant, but I do see them as recurring over and over as conditions and people change. Judgment is essential to this project, and the communities of care will become one of the most important communities of judgment one participates in. So here I want to just briefly meet a potential objection of the socialism takes too many evenings variety, with an assertion of the value of the interactions communities of care will entail. And this is also a response to the coercion concern. One of the benefits of these new norms is the sort of flip side of the problem of coercion. I think both the process of deliberation I'm advocating and the new norms I propose would foster relations of freedom. Freedom is, of course, as we talked about yesterday, not just an absence of constraint. There is never a complete absence of constraint, and the inevitability of coercive norms is an important example of that. Good norms, even with their inevitable coercion, can foster the human relations that constitute and enable freedom. To the extent that people are generating a thriving conversation about the norms of care and employment and their relation to gender norms, they are building relations of freedom. In Arendtian terms, we construct our shared world, the public space that both binds and separates us, through relations of freedom. The issues of care and employment are especially important topics of collective world building because they further dismantle long-standing divides of public and private by bringing care into the public realm of collective deliberation. The very process of doing so brings to light the intertwining of the intimate, family life and sexual bonding, the economic and the political, and the need for all to be subject to collective deliberation. This, of course, is not at all Arendtian. Privacy will necessarily be part of the conversation, as will the appropriate scope for personal choice and preference. In addition, the norms of care responsibilities that extend beyond family and friends will generate a sense of the importance of bonds of community. These norms will create networks of connection, bonding, reciprocity, and understanding. And I envision that the complex questions of the nature of our responsibilities for neighbors will generate ongoing conversation. Indeed, as we develop our collective understanding of care and its intertwining with employment and with various forms of volunteer work and activism, the norms of care will evolve, meaning ongoing conversation, meaning the ongoing building of relations of freedom. Thank you.
Jennifer Nadelsky, Professorial Fellow at the Institute for Social Justice, Australian Catholic University, and Professor of Law at the University of Toronto. Her paper, Restructuring Work and Care, was presented at the Sydney School for Critical Social Thought earlier this year. The week-long seminar was hosted by the Institute for Social Justice at the Australian Catholic University, North Sydney. And our thanks to the Institute for providing audio of Professor Nadelsky's address. That's Big Ideas for tonight and for the week. On behalf of the production team, I'm Paul Barclay. Until next time, bye for now.